Welcome to Post View.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is David Camparelli. I'm the Federal Project Officer for the Welfare Peer TA Network. I'd like to welcome you today to our webinar on green jobs, reaching TANF and low-income populations. We have a lot of really highly trained experts here who are very well known in their fields, and the Office of Family Assistance is highly dedicated to creating new, sustainable, and environmentally friendly jobs. Today's presentations will be recorded, so all of the presentations will be recorded and posted on the Welfare Peer TA Network, where you could access it in the next few days if you miss any part of the webinar. And I'd like to turn it over to our facilitator for today, Brent Orwell. Brent?
Thanks, David. I think we've got a few slides here at the outset dealing with the webinar learning objectives and also some of the logistics. I'm going to address the learning objectives, and then I believe Stephanie Barr from our staff, from ICF staff, is going to address logistics. The webinar learning objectives are, one, to provide TANF and workforce development agencies with an overview of green jobs and the connections and links to reaching TANF and low-income populations, to offer strategies for participants interested in implementing green workforce development programs in their states, tribes, territories, and local agencies and communities, to provide agencies with a conceptual model of green jobs, training programs, and what constitutes quality training programs, and to highlight initiatives creating green jobs in manufacturing and energy efficiency, and address mechanisms to make sure green jobs are good jobs. Go to the next slide.
Okay. Thank you, Brent. And if everyone can see here, this is our agenda for the webinar today. And right now, I just wanted to go through a little bit of logistics. There will be a live question and answer session at the end of the presentation where the operator will explain how to ask a question through the phone when the presentations are complete. In addition to that, we will be using live meeting to ask questions. So if you think of a question that you'd like to ask during the middle of the presentation, you can send the question in using live meeting. This way you don't have to wait until the end, and you'll be able to also ask more than one question. So if you look at your screen in front of you, there are three quick steps. The first is to click up at the top where it says Q&A. Next, type in your question. And then third, click Ask to submit your question. Your question will get sent to us, and then we will send you a response to let you know we've gotten it. And when we've received your response or your question and you've gotten the response back, you're actually free to ask another question. So please don't hold back. And again, we will also address the questions at the end of the presentations, with the exception of our first speaker, who we will be addressing questions right after her presentation.
And Stephanie, why don't we back up just one slide and run through the agenda very quickly and cover that change in the program. Everything will occur here in the order it's been listed, except that our third speaker, Michelle McGoy, will be going first. And as Stephanie said, we're going to take some questions for her immediately after she's done because she can't be with us for the entire time. And then Elena Fauché will be our second speaker, and Jennifer Cleary will be the third speaker. We'll go to Q&A after that. So you can advance us now to the slides. Okay, first slide we've got here. The question that is kind of on everyone's lips and minds, what is a green job? Everybody wants to know what the definitions are, at this point, I would say that green jobs are very broadly defined. The White House report from the Middle Class Task Force, chaired by the Vice President, defines green jobs as employment that is associated with some aspect of environmental improvement. I would add that in many cases, green jobs exist within regular jobs, that there are aspects of jobs that aren't in the green sector entirely, but have green elements to them. But here are some examples of kind of jobs that might be considered green workforce or green collar jobs: bicycle repair and delivery services, car and truck mechanic jobs, things that help reduce pollution, production jobs, and gas station jobs related to biodiesel, vegetable oil, and other alternative fuels. Energy retrofits. Retrofits is a fancy word for talking about efforts to improve the energy efficiency of buildings. It could be new windows, it could be insulation, it could be advanced lighting controls to reduce the amount of energy being consumed by a building. Food production using organic and sustainably grown agricultural products is also green. Furniture made from environmentally certified and recycled wood is another example. And then manufacturing jobs related to large-scale production of a wide range of appropriate technologies, for example, solar panels, bike cargo systems, green waste bins, and other alternative energy, energy efficiency, and clean technology manufacturing. We can go to the next slide. Okay, so I wanted to take just a minute and talk about the green initiatives across the administration, investments that are being made by the federal government that are intended to achieve a number of objectives, and one of those objectives is to spur growth in green jobs broadly across the economy. For instance, we have an $11 billion smart grid program at the Department of Energy to improve energy systems, the actual delivery of electricity, and to improve efficiencies. There's a $6 billion loan guarantee program to support the expansion of green industries through the Small Business Administration. There's a $5 billion weatherization assistance program that operates in states and localities across the country to assist low-income families in weatherizing their homes. And then there's additional billions to improve energy efficiency in all kinds of public buildings, schools, and public housing. These green principles and programs, or the green theme, can be found in virtually every aspect of the administration's policies and initiatives. There would be very few elements of public policy that are not being impacted by a new look through the green lens at how those policies affect, in particular, carbon emissions. Next slide. So, one aspect of the of this green theme across the federal government is green job training programs. Back in 2007, then Congresswoman and now Secretary of Labor Hilda Solis was the principal author of the Green Jobs Act of 2007 that was included in a broader energy bill passed by Congress in 2007. And this Green Jobs Act of 2007 provided the authorization, the legal framework to create the development of green workforce programs. The program was authorized, that is, Congress said to the Labor Department they could go ahead and do this, but funding was never provided until 2009. The Green Jobs Act targets two sort of spheres of worker populations that it's particularly concerned with. It's particularly concerned with, first, workers that have been displaced by national energy or environmental policy. So in other words, if, say, the federal government passed the cap-and-trade legislation on carbon emissions, and that resulted in certain workers in certain sectors, say, perhaps people in the coal industry, having to find other work, they would be priority for training. The second priority is a cluster of workers who are low income. They could be veterans who get a preference for training under the Green Jobs Act, at-risk youth, kids who are out of school but not graduated, for instance, or people with criminal records who need training in order to be employed. Those are all priority groups under the Green Jobs Act of 2007. And then it also targets particular industries, and you've seen those or heard those discussed earlier, but the energy efficiency industries with weatherization, insulation, advanced lighting controls, those kinds of programs that are designed to improve the energy efficiency of the U.S. economy, renewable energy, solar, wind, geothermal, for instance, to train people in those renewable energy sectors, clean manufacturing, the kind of production of goods and services that reduces the environmental impact, and then biofuels, biodiesel, ethanol, and those and like industries. And then the statute also authorized particular expressions of these programs. So we've got the statute authorizing labor market information grants, pathways out of poverty grants to assist low-income individuals in getting into green job training programs, energy training partnership, which is more focused on labor management coalitions to train people for work, and then finally state energy sector partnership grants, which were to state labor agencies to help states coordinate their own strategies around green job development. Next slide. Okay, so as I said, the statute was created in 2007, but it wasn't funded until 2009 with the passage of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, ARRA, which provided $500 million for implementation of that the Green Jobs Act of 2007. These grants were competed and awarded in 2009, the very beginning of 2010. A few of the last awards came out, and they're currently in the very early stages of implementation on these grants, the grantees who received the funds. There's $55 million for those labor market information grants to help states or state consortia, groups of states, understand what the labor market demands were in green sectors in their states. So some of the states and states consortia are studying their own labor markets, trying to figure out where the jobs are or where they will be in the future. There's $100 million for the energy training partnership grants, 25 grants to labor unions, community-based organizations, educational institutions like community colleges, to actually do training in renewable energy and energy efficiency programs. There was $150 million for the Pathways Out of Poverty grant, and there were 38 of those grants to community-based organizations, state and local governments, educational institutions, and other organizations. And those are the ones that are really tightly focused on low-income populations, ex-offenders, TANF recipients, and similarly situated populations that need additional help and training for green workforce. And then $190 million went to the state energy sector partnerships, and there were 34 grants to state labor departments to coordinate sector-based training initiatives for green-collar jobs. Next slide, please. Okay. Pathways Out of Poverty. I wanted to just focus on this for a minute because I think it really is the best target for TANF program administrators and other organizations seeking green job partnerships, because it's so focused on the populations that you are already, the TANF programs are already working with. We have low-income adult and youth training in targeted sectors. Under 200, people have to be under 200% of the federal poverty level. So that's the focus of those grants, is really trying to get at those populations where there is a high level of poverty and need. I think that the most interesting facet of this Pathways Out of Poverty program is that it requires grantees to be able to recruit. They have to, in other words, recruit potential trainees out of the communities of need, train them, and then support those participants as they move through training and into employment. And I think the other really interesting aspect of the program is that it requires coordinated supportive services. And this is a big issue, as you all know, in trying to assist low-income populations in transition to work, is that there's a multiplicity of needs, many of which are not strictly work-related, but are critical to success if people, low-income populations, are going to succeed in the workplace: transportation, childcare, sometimes substance abuse or mental health, you name it, remedial education, you name it. There's a whole host of needs, and these grants are really supposed to be providing that kind of tight coordination of supportive services around trainees. We can go to the next slide. Just want to give you one example from the Pathways Out of Poverty grant program. This is one of the largest grants that was let. It's the National Association of Regional Councils. And it, they received $8 million from the U.S. Department of Labor that they are subawarding out to five regional government agencies. It could be a council of county governments. It could be or a county government that's covering a broader geographic area. And they're assisting workers in high-poverty communities through job readiness training and transitional employment opportunities in alternative energy, materials reuse, and energy efficiency programs. And the grant is leveraging partnerships with community-based organizations, for example, Native American tribes, ex-offender reentry programs, and other programs to recruit, train, and retain workers. So you can kind of get a little bit of a flavor of how these programs are set up to recruit and then provide the support networks that low-income populations often need as they're transitioning from into careers and into the workforce. So, next slide. And this slide I just included, if you are interested in getting more information on these DOL Green Workforce Training Grants in your state or city or region, go to this website, www.dol.gov/DOL/green, and you'll find a page that's devoted to the initiative. And there are links built into that page for each of the categories and grants that I talked about, including Pathways Out of Poverty. Next slide. The funding outlook for the program for the Green Jobs program at DOL, there's currently $490 million that has been awarded out of the $500 million that Congress appropriated under the stimulus bill. And those grants all represent possible partnerships for TANF programs, community-based organizations, and others. It's not too late to reach out to the folks who are operating those grants and try to become a partner with them. In the fiscal year 10 budget, Congress approved an additional $40 million for the Green Job Innovation Fund. It's not clear at this point how the department is going to be handling that, whether there will be new competitions, or whether these funds will be used to award grants that were found to be very meritorious of funding in the review process, but there just wasn't enough money to go around in the first tranche of funds that went out at the end of 2009. So we'll just have to stay tuned and see what the department decides to do with that. And then in the fiscal year 11 budget, $85 million has been requested by the President for the Green Job Innovation Fund. So this will be a multi-year, very robust commitment by the federal government to invest in these kinds of training programs. Next slide.
I think that's it, Brent.
Okay, thanks. I want to just take a moment here to introduce our speakers and make sure I get these in the right order. Our first speaker is going to be Michelle McGoy. I'm sorry, I knew I was going to get that wrong. Michelle McGoy, she is the founder and executive director of the California-based Solar Richmond. Solar Richmond is a nonprofit organization that Ms. McGoy founded in 2006 to serve the community through green-collar job training and placement in the solar industry. Solar Richmond works closely with diverse partners in city government, the nonprofit sector, and local businesses in order to foster a green economy in Richmond and bring good green jobs to its residents. Solar Richmond serves as a model for addressing both local concerns of violence reduction and infrastructure investment in the global concern of climate change. Our second speaker is Elena Fauché of the Apollo Alliance. Since joining the Apollo Alliance as research associate in September of 2008, Elena has written numerous policy briefs, memos, and data points on green economic development, job quality standards, workforce development, and energy policy. She has been deeply involved in the Apollo Alliance's work to inform Congress and the public about clean energy and green collar job provisions in the 2009 American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and has prepared a number of memos and presentations on opportunities related to its implementation. Prior to joining Apollo, she did research for the Labor Center at the University of California, Berkeley, where she conducted a study in Contra Costa County on opportunities in the green economy for cities and training programs, and published a paper on strategies for ensuring that green jobs are quality jobs. And then finally, Jennifer Cleary will be joining us from Rutgers University. Jennifer is a senior project manager at the John Heldrick Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey. With the center since 2000, Cleary's current work is focused on developing industry-based intelligence on labor demand and supply issues, including those in clean energy industries. Cleary also assists policymakers to develop and implement research-based workforce and employer engagement strategies that promote economic growth. She completed work on the workforce issues facing clean energy employers in New Jersey and co-authored the Heldrick Center research brief preparing the workforce for a green jobs economy. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Michelle so she can give us her presentation, and then we'll have a few minutes for questions for her before we go on to our other speakers.
Hi, this is Michelle. I'm the executive director and founder of Solar Richmond. Just a little bit about my background. I'm a kind of a recovering computer entrepreneur, had run a couple different software companies, then started a nonprofit dealing with the digital divide around 10 years ago. Then when I got into the solar field, I saw that the eco divide was just as bad, if not worse, than the digital divide, and I started Solar Richmond. Hold on, I got to figure out how to advance my slides here. I don't seem to be able to advance my slides. Stephanie, is there a? I'm hitting an arrow key.
If you click on thumbnails up at the top by content.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm good. Okay. Sorry.
Great.
Thank you. Thanks. So Richmond, we're in California, Northern California. So we're just about 20 minutes north of San Francisco, and we're called the City of Pride and Purpose. As you can see, we've got a lot of coastline here. But unfortunately, in Richmond, we're actually more known for our pollution and violence. We have a Chevron refinery here in our backyard, and it's a big industrial area. And then last year, we had the highest per capita murder rate in the state. So I kind of felt like solar was one good antidote to pollution and jobs a good antidote to violence, and that's what inspired me to start Solar Richmond. So we I started it in 2006, and we're a nonprofit, and we partner with the City of Richmond. And so the training that we run with the City of Richmond, they run a program called Richmond Build, which is a pre-apprenticeship construction training program. And so the students come through a 7-week pre-apprenticeship construction training, and then they do a 3-week energy efficiency training, and then we do a 4-week solar installation training. And as a part of the training, we actually go out into the community and we install 2 live systems on the homes of low-income homeowners. And the way that's funded is the redevelopment agency offers the homeowner a loan that is deferred so that it basically doesn't have to get repaid until the homeowner moves. So the homeowner basically gets the parts at cost, they get the labor for free, and then they get this deferred loan through the redevelopment agency. To get into the training program, the only requirements are a GED and being able to pass an 8th grade math and reading level test. Sorry, these slides move slower than I have to anticipate. So far we've taught 9 cohorts, and we've placed 18 people in full-time job opportunities, 8 in these 10-week paid internships that we do, and 26 in temporary solar positions. And we've installed 12 systems on low-income homeowners' houses. And we've been called a model program in a lot of different areas, from Green for All and Apollo Alliance, and the senator came out and gave us an award, and we're highlighted in Van Jones' book and the U.S. Conference of Mayors as a best practice green collar job training program, and we've gotten a tremendous amount of media. And, you know, been on Dan Rather reports and a bunch of other different things. But the reality is, you know, in terms of the number of job placements that we have made, you know, we're not jumping up and down shouting about it and are hoping that the solar market is going to turn around. So there have been sort of different barriers and challenges in getting our graduates into full-time positions. You know, one is that just in this last year with what's happened with the economy, the solar market did get hit, and so that's one piece. But what we're also finding is that there's a culture gap, that many of the solar companies are run by folks who don't really connect particularly well with our graduate base. And that there's a big competition for meaningful work. And so our graduates are competing with college graduates for these jobs. And, you know, a college graduate walks into an interview and they start talking about Al Gore and global warming and CO2 emissions and how they went rock climbing last week and they're going kayaking next week. And they make a connection that our guys really, really aren't making. And then the other piece, you know, the other sort of barrier is what I call the clean conscience factor. And just describing that quickly is, you know, what it is that many of the folks who run solar companies kind of feel like, well, we're doing our piece to make the planet cleaner, to do environmental work, and let's let someone else worry about issues of poverty, race, and class. So that's been a real barrier for us. There are some companies that we've partnered with who are excited about hiring our graduates, but there is this culture gap of this sort of clean conscience factor that we have to deal with. This picture here, the Crescent Park Housing had installed a very large system on a local affordable housing program. But then locally here, we've got SunPower, which is, they manufacture the largest the most efficient panel in the world, and they're literally across the freeway from us. And they just this last year installed over 3,500 panels and didn't bring any of our graduates on the job, which was obviously a big disappointment. There was another local installation, very large installation with a wastewater treatment plant, over 4,500 panels installed. None of our graduates got put on that job. And so one of the things that we've found is that these barriers are significant, and in order for us to be able to provide deeper opportunities for our graduates and really to be able to, in essence, move the interview from the desktop up to the rooftop, we've created a staffing agency so that any installer can bring our graduates on a temporary basis. And then we work with consumers to create a demand. And what we're trying to do is to get consumers to say, not only do I want to do something good for the planet, but I also care about communities, and I want to do something good for communities in need. And getting the consumers to tell these installers, yes, I want solar on my roof, and I want 30% of the labor to come from a graduate from the program. And so that's been one way to drive more work to our graduates through this staffing agency. And then we've also developed a paid internship where recently a company called Real Goods had sold a good-sized system, a 412-kilowatt system, to a local housing development, and they hired 8 of our graduates to do a 10-week internship, paid living wage, and during that time we also provided the graduates with professional development and case management. So we're wanting to move to more of those opportunities. With the last piece, in one of the challenges in working with these companies is that we don't get to control how many people we get on the job. So what we're doing now is we're working on a sort of an entrepreneurial effort to bring in investors. And we just actually brought in our first investor last week. And basically the concept is that Solar Richmond will become a power company. And the idea is that we will install solar systems on the rooftops of nonprofit buildings who don't have the capital to afford buying solar, and then they'll buy the power back from us. So a couple years ago, we worked with a church that really wanted solar but didn't have the capital to be able to invest. And basically we brought together many of the congregation members and formed a small LLC, a small company, so that the congregants could take the tax benefits basically pass those back through to the church. So for the church, there was no upfront cost, and for nonprofits who can't take the tax benefit, it was a way of getting an additional 30% discount of a benefit there. So the concept here is that Solar Richmond, as a nonprofit, has a wholly owned subsidiary, which is a for-profit that can take advantage of the tax benefits, and will be installing systems on nonprofit buildings. And the advantage to the nonprofit building is that they don't have to come up with any cash at all, and they get a decrease in their energy costs, and they get stabilized rates of electricity over the life of the system. And then they can also market this to their donor base, so they can now say they're a green child care center. And basically then we work with local vendors to partner with them, and then we get to dictate the amount of labor that goes on the job, which is a part of the agreement we have with them. And then we've got investors who are both, we're bringing in grants from nonprofits, program-related foundation loans, equity investment, and tax credit investment as well. So this is a structure that we've just just put together and are pitching, brought in our first investor. And what we're pitching to investors is that that they can get, that they'll, from their investment, get a quadruple line, so a bottom line, so basically a financial return on investment of between 2 and 13%. They'll be creating pathways out of poverty and into prosperity for graduates of our program. There are the environmental benefits, and then they're also helping the capacity for nonprofits by decreasing their operating costs for electricity and creating a long-term revenue stream for Solar Richmond. So we're really pitching this to environmental, socially responsible investors. And what the investors are very interested in is not just for us to put together a program that's going to be effective here in Richmond, but what they want to see is how can we do this in cities around the country. So we're talking to different cities about being able to offer this same kind of structure. And what's exciting to us here in Richmond about solar and renewable energy is that it's so powerful to see these men and women up on the rooftop within their own communities participating in this new green economy, and really renewing communities and renewing lives within the community. And our goal is not just to create entry-level jobs, but really to create leaders in this new green economy. So that's my pitch, or my not a pitch. There's my presentation, and I'm open to questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. If you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. Once again, to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4. And our first question comes from the line of Deborah Pontiso. Please proceed.
Oh, okay. I've been pushing buttons here. Thank you. I'm with the Federal Office of Child Support, and I just, the reason we're interested in this, because we, you know, a lot of the families in our caseload are low income, particularly low income fathers who are being taxed to pay child support and yet are finding it difficult to even provide for themselves. But anyway, I think what you're doing is phenomenal. And I hope there's a website that you can point us to so we can learn more about your program, and also hopefully these PowerPoints will be available to us at the end. But I wanted to ask you a quick question. Are you getting any money from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act? Are you getting any training funds from the Department of Labor to help offset the training costs for the folks in your program?
Great. Thanks for your question, Deborah. So first of all, our website is www.solarrichmond.org.
Okay.
In terms of funding, we did not get any money through the Pathways Out of Poverty grant.
Oh.
And as a nonprofit, we were not able to take the lead on the application, which was a big disappointment for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a part of what contributed to, you know, to not being selected. We are getting a little bit of funding through the Energy Training Partners grant,
mm-hmm.
but most of our funding is coming from foundations and individual donors.
Okay. I don't know much about the pathways to poverty to end poverty program, but it just seems to me that this is exactly what at least the goal is that, you know, you are providing, because training is very expensive, isn't it, for these
yes.
folks?
Yeah.
And, I mean, how do you recoup that? I mean, you're spending the money up front, and then how do you get some money? You need a continuous funding stream to at least train the folks. And this would be a benefit to companies, I would think. Then they don't have to spend it training their workers, although you did mention about the cultural gap between
yes,
the educated
yeah.
and the non-educated. So
right, right.
But
so,
it just
so
seems...
Yeah.
It just seems to me, being a private solar energy company would say, hey, we can save some money on the bottom line if we take recruits from this training program, because then we won't have to train them ourselves. But anyway.
That would be the hope, and so far that hasn't been the reality, given that that it is a crowded market in that we've got all these college grads wanting a foot in the door.
Okay.
But it is a part of why we're really looking at an entrepreneurial model that's not just dependent on grant dollars, but the idea is that as we install more of these systems on the rooftops of nonprofit buildings, they will be buying power from us.
So basically
they'll be buying power from us, and that will create a revenue source which will help to fund the training.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Brent. I think in deference to our other speakers, we probably ought to maybe have one more question and then move and let you go and let the others come on. And then we will obviously keep the questions open, and we will endeavor to facilitate getting responses for anyone who didn't get a chance to ask their question in person. So if there is one more question, let's take that, and then we'll move to the next speaker.
Actually, Brent, we had two questions via live meeting email.
Okay.
One was, when did Solar Richmond start? And then the second one was, do you work with your local LIB?
So I started Solar Richmond in 2006. We did our first training in 2007. And our local LIB is actually the city of Richmond. Has its own WIB, so it's not a county-based WIB, and it's pretty much run by the Employment and Training Department, and so we do work with them, yes.
That's a work investment board for those of you who are not speaking governmentees who might be on the line.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much for that presentation, Michelle. Thank you for being with us. And we're going to move now to our next speaker, Elena Fauché from the Apollo Alliance.
Hi. Can somebody pull up my slides? Great. Hi. Thanks for inviting me. Can you move to the first slide of my presentation? Solar Richmond is an excellent organization. We definitely know them well. I'm going to step back a little bit. It's kind of funny. We ended up going in reverse, so we're going to the very specific program example to stepping back. I'm going to give several state and local examples similar to Solar Richmond, similar and different to Solar Richmond. And then I believe Jennifer is going to step back even farther and talk about training models overall. So we're going in reverse. First, the Apollo Alliance, for those of you who don't know us, we're a coalition of business, labor, environment, and community-based organizations. We have an overarching vision for moving our economy towards clean energy and creating good jobs. We work towards three things: energy security, climate stability, and economic prosperity for all. Can you go to the next slide? This I just put in there. President Obama has made a very clear commitment to investing in clean energy and creating green jobs. We heard before about the $110 billion is what we added up, that the Recovery Act invested in clean energy and green job training. And that was just the beginning. The fiscal year 2011 budgets for the Department of Energy, Department of Transportation, Department of Labor are all making significant investments in clean energy that are going to create green jobs in the short term. Unfortunately, we still lack a big federal strategy for moving us towards a clean energy economy. The climate energy bill is stalled in Congress. So in the meantime, states and cities all over the country are already leaders in clean energy investment and green jobs innovation. Can you go to the next slide? Next slide, please. Thanks. So I want to highlight five specific areas of state and local innovation. These are areas that the Recovery Act has helped invest in and help build, but other, state, local funding streams are being directed into creating jobs in these areas. The first is manufacturing. Can you go to the manufacturing slide? So manufacturing is critical to many states, especially, you know, those in the Midwest like Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Indiana. Their economies have depended on manufacturing jobs for a long time and are experiencing a lot of job decline in the manufacturing sector. And what's important about manufacturing jobs is that they are good jobs. They tend to provide middle-class wages, and they're available to workers, the 68% of American workers who don't have college degrees. So it's important that we pay attention to decline of manufacturing jobs in states across the country, but especially in Midwest states. And Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, California are all looking at strategies to build up manufacturing jobs by investing in clean energy. And I wanted to share with you a couple of examples of how some states are doing that. Michigan, I think, is the best. Michigan combined their Department of Energy with their Department of Labor and Economic Growth so that the integrated departments could look at a comprehensive strategy that would reinvest in the state's manufacturing sector and create good jobs for workers and then provide training that would help workers access jobs in the growing parts of the economy. So a couple of the things, I'm just going to highlight a couple of things that Michigan is doing. First, advanced battery manufacturing. So the Recovery Act invested $2 billion in creating an advanced battery sector in the United States with the goal of building electric cars here, right? There's an anticipated demand for electric vehicles, and we have not so far had the capacity to build the components here. So Michigan, of that $2 billion, $1.3 billion, I believe, went to the state of Michigan, to companies located in Michigan, to manufacture the batteries or the components for the batteries. So that's exciting. It's creating manufacturing jobs. The state's Clean Energy Advanced Manufacturing Program is another Recovery Act innovation. $15 million of, I think it's the state's State Energy Program funds, are going towards auto parts manufacturers who are, you know, shutting down left and right in Michigan to retool to be able to make components for wind turbines, for solar panels, and, again, create jobs for manufacturing workers. And then the state's No Worker Left Behind program, for those of you who don't know it, it provides 2 years of free training to workers who want to enter into high-growth industries. And so, you know, advanced battery manufacturing and renewable energy component part manufacturing are two of those high-growth industries. So it really creates a way it's really creating jobs in the state and then creating a way for workers to access those jobs. It's pretty exciting. Wisconsin, Indiana, and Pennsylvania all used a portion of their state energy program funds from the Recovery Act to create similar revolving loan programs to help manufacturers retool to make, you know, wind turbine parts and other clean energy component parts. And then I wanted to specifically highlight another example. You know, earlier when Brent was talking about what a green job is, there was one sector that was left out, which I think is important, which is transportation. Public transit reduces greenhouse gas emissions and, you know, is a career pathway for many folks that is unionized and pays good wages. So Portland, the city of Portland, used some of their Recovery Act funds and then other states and city funds to build a streetcar line. And when they did that, they wanted to make sure that jobs building those streetcars were captured in the state of Oregon and preferably in the city of Portland. So they partnered with Oregon Iron Works, which is a local company, to build United Streetcar to make the first U.S.-made streetcars in a very, very long time with the help of federal grants. The United Streetcar is a union company. They're organized by the iron workers, and the iron workers host apprenticeship programs in the facility to train workers to make streetcars. So it's pretty exciting. And I just actually had a meeting with the CEO of United Streetcar, and one of the things she said, which is something I've heard from many other clean energy companies, is there's a shortage of skilled welders. So if you're looking for a specific skill that feeds into the green economy, apparently welding is one. Can you move on to the next slide? So energy efficiency, this is something that we've heard a lot about. The Recovery Act has helped cities create really innovative, large-scale energy efficiency programs. And the idea is that funding structure would be set up so that homeowners and building owners could do energy efficiency retrofits at no upfront cost. So they can make improvements to their heating systems, they can seal the building envelope, make other improvements that are going to reduce their energy consumption, sometimes up to as much as 30%, at least 15% is pretty common. And this is going to create jobs in the construction sector. The retrofits are done at no upfront cost to the home and building owner. They repay it over time through their property tax bill or the utility bill. Different programs are designed a little bit differently. And workers in the construction sector have access to these jobs to do the retrofit work. Portland is one particular example I wanted to highlight because Portland, they've developed this pilot program that includes a community workforce agreement that guarantees that the jobs created in their large-scale energy efficiency program are good jobs. I'm going to talk a whole lot more about the community workforce agreement in a second. Another good example is Boston. Boston is developing a pilot energy efficiency pilot program, which is hopefully going to go, which is going to go statewide. It's focused on a community organizing model. So community groups in the neighborhood where the pilot project is taking place are involved in creating buy-in. So they're talking to their neighbors. They have like organizers going out talking to their neighbors about retrofits, getting them interested in doing retrofits. And then they're working with local labor unions to provide training, and the community groups are helping to find people that want to enter into that training so that local people are employed doing the retrofits in local homes, which is pretty exciting. So next slide. So, you know, investments in manufacturing, investments in energy efficiency, investments in renewable energy are creating green jobs, but there's no guarantee that these jobs are going to be good jobs or that they'll go to the people that need them most unless we look at standards, building in standards to program design. So some of the equity and job quality standards that are really important include, you know, wage standards such as prevailing wage or other living wage standards, guarantees that jobs will provide benefits like health insurance and paid sick time, targeted and local hiring, and I'm going to explain what that is in a second, responsible employer requirements, so that's requirements that contractors participating in the program meet wage or benefit standards, have good safety records, hire locally, whatever requirements the local area wants to place on them. And then connection with training for career pathways. I'll talk more about that in a second, too. So if you can go to the next slide. This, I know, you know, I've been talking kind of big picture. This is a concrete example of what job quality standards might look like. So the Portland Clean Energy Works Program, which is the energy efficiency program, they have this community workforce agreement that says that any contractor that wants to do retrofits as part of this program has to hire 80% of their workers locally from within the city of Portland, that 30% of the work hours have to be performed by target populations, and the target populations are those who have been historically disadvantaged or underrepresented, so that includes people of color, women, low-income residents. Wages have to be paid at 180% of state minimum wage or prevailing wage, which applies to certain building trades, but not all. And then 20% of project dollars have to go to women and minority-owned businesses. So they really wanted to make sure that women and minority-owned contractors have access to doing retrofit work. Then 50% of total work hours have to be done by training program graduates. So there are specific training programs that are preparing workers for energy efficiency retrofits. And contractors who are participating in Portland Clean Energy Works have to hire enough workers so that 50% of work hours are done by those program graduates. Contractors also have to agree to labor peace, which means that they will, if a union, if workers decide that they want to join the union, the contractor agrees that they're not going to stand in the way. And then best value contracting, which is a term that means that you know, when the governing agency is looking at which contractors they want to work with for this program, you know, they're going to look at whether the contractors can meet all these different community workforce agreement standards, not just, you know, which contractor is going to do the work at the lowest cost. So if you can go to the next slide.
Elena, this is Ed's friend. We probably need to take about 3 minutes or so to wrap up, if you can, so that we our final speaker can talk, and then we can go to Q&A.
Sure, no problem. So I'll just go through these next two slides really quickly. There was two things I really wanted to highlight as important to making sure that green jobs are accessible to the populations that we care about. One is the idea of career pathways, and this comes from a series of papers that are available on our website that are called Mapping Green Career Pathways, Job Training Infrastructure and Opportunities in Wisconsin, Ohio, and Michigan. Basically, what the papers talk about is that we need to design career pathways built into, you know, clean energy investments that prepare students, prepare workers for building on skills and participating in training, building on skills so that they have transferable skills, they can get better and better jobs, higher and higher pay, and access opportunities available to them. Union apprenticeships are one example of how these career pathways are built into training. You know, there's a very clear you enter in as an apprenticeship. There's, you know, first year apprentice, second year apprentice. You increase in pay as you go along through training. Then there's a direct link with employers. So graduates are now journey level. They can access union employers. And some training programs partner with community colleges so that classroom hours get community college credits, so that graduates can earn an associate's degree in addition to being a journey level worker. Can you go to the next slide? So training partnerships, this is where I'm going to end. Training partnerships are really important to building quality career pathways because they build connections between the different elements of the workforce development system. The Green Jobs Act really prioritized supporting partnerships that included not just workforce development agencies, but also education institutions, labor unions, and community-based organizations that serve low-income folks and those with barriers to employment that we want to make sure have access to green jobs. There's many examples. I'm not going to go into them right now, but there's many examples of how these training programs work on the ground to really help workers get access to the basic skills they need to enter union apprenticeships or community colleges, and then have access to real jobs through partnerships with employers. And Solar Richmond is one example of how that works on the ground. But I'm going to stop there so that we have time for questions.
Thank you very, very much, Elena, for that presentation. And we're going to be moving on to our final speaker now. So no further ado, please take it away.
Hello. Okay. This is Jennifer Cleary from the Heldrich Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. And just to give you a little bit of background on the Heldrich Center, we've been around since about 1997, and we're the leading university-based research center focused on workforce development issues. And I've been involved in doing industry-related studies across a wide variety of industries, including green jobs, for several years now. I've been with the center for about 10 years, and before that, I actually worked in social work, and I ran a homeless shelter for a while. So in my work here at the center, I really try to think back to those days and to try to provide recommendations that are useful and actionable for people who are dealing with some of the challenges that you face when you're dealing with people who have multiple barriers to employment. So let's just move right into the presentation here. And, actually, I'm not quite sure how to advance the slide. Is it down? There we go. Okay. So I think first let's start off by talking about what makes planning for green training different than planning for training for any other industry. There are many similarities, of course, but a few things that make green different are the role of public policy in job creation, as Brent and others have talked about. Public policy is right now really, I think, the leading force in job creation. And it interacts with a number of other forces, which I'll talk about in a minute. But that's very important because it has consequences for who you need to consult when you're trying to assess demand, when you're trying to figure out what the demand really is for various jobs and within various industries. And also, as Brent had mentioned earlier, green jobs, although, you know, the term makes it seem as if these are brand new jobs, and there are a few of those that are relatively new or emerging occupations, even those that are new and emerging are often based on traditional skill sets in construction or manufacturing or other industries, and many jobs are actually those traditional jobs. They just happen to be taking place in a new context. So insulators, for example, will tell you that they've been a green job for 100 years or more. So the consequence of that is that you need to keep in mind that just adding that green layer of skills or credentials is often not enough to make people truly competitive, especially in this labor market. You know, as Michelle had talked about it, it's very, very competitive out there, and folks are often competing against people who have experience in these traditional industries, especially given the layoffs in manufacturing and construction, as well as people who have college degrees. So let me just move on here. Okay, so this is just a little graphic that shows the various things that are influencing job growth. You know, you, of course, have technology advances, and as the technology advances, it makes things cheaper. It makes a lot of the energy efficiency and renewable energy technologies more affordable. And, of course, that interacts with the economy because a lot of the public policies that are out there that are stimulating investment in energy efficiency and renewable energy still rely on the customer, whether it be a business or a homeowner, to make some kind of investment. Some places are getting creative about that and trying to cut out that upfront investment, but in a lot of areas it still requires some commitment. So it makes things a little bit uncertain. And then, of course, there's this changing culture, this emerging consciousness about making things green that's also very helpful in getting people to begin to adopt this. A lot of these technologies. But right now, really, it is public policy. And public policy really takes two forms in driving job creation. One are the direct incentives, you know, the incentive to invest in an energy audit and making your home more energy efficient. The second are other policies that structure the market to make it more likely for green businesses to thrive. So a lot of states, for example, are implementing green purchasing agreements, making sure that all of their government agencies are purchasing greener products, for example. So that's going to drive demand for those products and hopefully drive up jobs. Okay. So a couple of key issues. Green jobs, one of the issues with green jobs that makes it difficult for providers and people who are trying to design training is this information gap about demand. Because a lot of the statistics that we're used to looking at to figure out whether an industry or job is growing or shrinking, from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, for example, they don't fit very well with green jobs because it's hard to tell whether an electrician is a green electrician who's working on an energy-efficient project or whether he's working on an energy-inefficient project, he or she. And so it does make things a little bit difficult to use the traditional sources of information about demand. So it makes it all the more important that you begin to form collaboratives and of course, directly interact with employers, but also at the very beginning to begin to touch base with the various policy people in your state that are controlling the money that is funding green job creation. So in New Jersey, the Board of Public Utilities is handling a lot of the ARRA money and also the state investments in energy efficiency and renewables. The EDA, the Economic Development Authority in the state, is handling a lot of the incentives for manufacturing. So it's important to keep in touch with them to understand how that money is flowing. Is it out there yet? Has it gone to particular employers? And working through them to begin to get access to the people who are getting the money that's then going to create the job. So it's really following the money that's important. And another thing that makes it a little bit challenging for providers to design training is that this is an industry that's really emerging very rapidly because the federal government, states, and local governments are creating new policies all of the time, and that's changing the whole structure of employment. And so it's really important then to create mechanisms that allow you to get continuous feedback about demand and not just take a look at a report that says somebody thinks that solar panel installer jobs are going to grow and call it a day. It's important to really create a system that allows you to get feedback directly from the policy folks and from the employers about how that that demand is really evolving in real time. And unfortunately, there are few systems that are in place really to do that. And some states and localities are beginning to develop them. And things like the training partnerships that Elena mentioned are helpful steps in that direction to at least begin to work on coordination of the existing training efforts. And I'll talk in a little bit about ways that you can begin to pull together the policy actors and others and really get a better sense of the demand. And this also, you know, leads us to needing better coordination amongst all of these entities listed here. Okay, so as I mentioned before, I mean, the most important thing to consider before you set up a program is the demand. You know, is there demand for the jobs in your local area? And, you know, that you have to be creative about trying to figure that out. You know, one of the things, the Aspen Institute, which has done a lot of work on sectoral strategies, which basically involve getting low-income folks connected to jobs in particular industries, have found in construction that the most successful programs are those that have done the work up front to connect with employers and essentially do contract training. So they're finding out first from the employers what their job needs are, and then they're training people with those credentials and with those skills to fill those jobs, as opposed to doing the training first and then working with employers to try to get those people placed. You know, and that's, I mean, part of that success is a function of the competitive economy that we're in right now. One good piece of news is that because of all of the public policy involvement, government actors are sometimes able to set aside a certain number of jobs that that are then directed to go to people who come from low-income programs that are designed to help low-income folks. And so, actually, Elena talked about a number of policies that cities and other places are adopting that require you to hire a local workforce and hire people with barriers to employment. In New Jersey, for example, the Department of Community Affairs is managing the federal weatherization money, and they've agreed to work with several nonprofits to hire about half of their new workers from these nonprofit organizations that are working in cities and we're training low-income workers. So that's, again, an important reason to get involved with these policy actors early on and develop those relationships first and then do the training. And it's, of course, also important to think not only about the number of people that are needed, but the credentials that are needed. And governments often play a role in that as well. As energy efficiency money is given out, often state agencies will set standards about which credentials contractors need to do that job. So an energy efficiency, BPI, is the Building Performance Institute, is a big one. But that can change by state. It's sort of the Wild West out there in terms of green credentialing right now, you know, with different standards and different credentials out there. So you have to be aware of both what employers are looking for in the private sector as well as what standards may have been set by government entities who may be funding a lot of this work. And then, of course, also you need to think about the existing pool of workers, you know, and the number of people who may be out there competing for similar jobs. And I think one of the values of creating the types of training partnerships that Elena talked about is really being aware of some of the other training that's going on, because one of the things that's happening is that so many people, so many community colleges and nonprofits and others are trying to get involved in green training, and if you have 6 or 7 entities in a small area all creating the same training, you're going to create an oversupply in the market. And so you need to understand what other people are doing and then begin to coordinate so that you can create these complementary programs that people can then be able to move up the ladder and not just have 10 of the same entry-level programs going on in an area. Okay, I'm going to move through this fairly quickly so we have enough time to get to questions. So our concept is really a talent network, which is similar to what Elena talked about in terms of a training partnership. I think our concept differs a little bit in that we add in this layer of coordination, hopefully at the state level, but it can also go on at the local level as well, in bringing the policy actors together to begin to talk about demand. And really to set up this continuous feedback loop that gives the providers information on demand so that the training partnerships can adjust what they're doing according to the demand as it evolves. And some of the key elements, I won't read them, but you can see them here. Stackable credentials and a variety of other things can be accomplished by these collaborative talent network efforts. And, some of the benefits are, of course, responding to demand as it evolves and helping to ensure that a diverse workforce gets access to the jobs that are being created. So here's just a model that we created, this sort of a visual model of how we conceptualize a talent network. So here at the top, these letters really just stand for some state agencies here in New Jersey. But these are the agencies, and you can see there are a lot of them, and there are things like the economic development, environmental protection, et cetera. They're all managing some of this federal and state money that's funding job creation. So those are the folks you need to pull together to begin to follow the money and figure out where the jobs are going to be. And they can play a leadership role. And then sort of at the bottom, where we have talent network members, I think that would be analogous to what Elena was talking about in terms of a training partnership. And so basically you work with the leadership council to begin to feed this sector information down to the folks who are doing the training and who are coordinating and beginning to plan these stackable credentials and to coordinate the training that they're doing. And, I think I've talked about a lot of this already, so we'll just go through that quickly. This is just a model. This is actually from some work that we had done in the transportation industry that just kind of shows what we're talking about when we talk about stackable credentials. It's basically making sure that within a given region or area that people do have access to various levels of training that are going to then lead them into higher and higher credentials that are recognized by employers. So it starts off more with certificates and sort of non-college degree-oriented credentials. But ideally, if you can get those to count for college credit that then lead into an associate's degree program, bachelor's, MBA, et cetera, that's really the ideal situation. Okay. Of course, a big component of this is really promoting effective partnerships. If you can't control all of this at the local level, you can at least look to see if there are existing partnerships going on in your local or regional area, or ideally at the state level. And you can think about perhaps beginning to start at least a local collaborative. Of course, when you're talking about measuring the success of your particular program, some things to think about beyond the obvious of job placement are things like formal partnership agreements with a variety of the entities we talked about, and also setting up labor union apprenticeships that are going to lead people into a pathway that provides them with additional training after they leave your facility and also access to well-paying jobs. acquisition of nationally recognized credentials and college credit as part of the training that you develop is also something to count as a success. And, of course, achieving sustainable matching revenue streams so that you can continue to grow your program after, you know, any particular grant that you may have gotten to start it is over. So I will stop there to allow time for questions. And thank you very much.
Okay, great. Brent, we have three questions here so far, and before I actually start the first one, operator, can you remind people on how to register a question via the phone?
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question on the phone lines, please press the 1 followed by the 4.
Okay. And while we wait for that, one of the questions that came in kind of concerns employers and giving them incentives or set-asides. Is there any type of current legislation or thought or maybe even state policies and legislation that provide incentives or set-asides for employers to actually employ low-income or pathways out of poverty or green job trainees?
Not that I know of particularly, other than the labor agreements that are happening in places like Los Angeles and Portland, I think was the other city Elena mentioned.
So this is Elena. I can answer that. So the Recovery Act included an incentive for employers that hire unemployed veterans and disconnected youth, I think is the term they use. And the Senate and House are in the process of passing or just passed a jobs bill that includes several incentives for employers that create jobs and hire unemployed workers. So that can potentially be directed towards employers that hire folks from particular populations that we care about.
Right. Oh,
this is Brent. I mean, one thing the administration has proposed, actually it's permissible under the existing statute, the TANF statute, to do subsidized employment programs. And there's no reason that a subsidized employment program couldn't be a green subsidized employment program. So that's sort of one area to look at. And I know the administration has asked for authority to expand the existing authority for subsidized employment as part of its fiscal year 11 budget proposals related to TANF. And so that there does seem to be some movement on the general topic of subsidized employment. There's certainly no reason why it couldn't be green subsidized employment.
Yeah, this is David at OFA. Just to tack my two cents onto what Brent said, you know, part of TANF is the requirement for work activities. One of those recognized work activities is either unsubsidized employment or subsidized employment. You know, so TANF, you know, any number of the $16+ billion a year of TANF block grant funds could be spent on employment and subsidized employment opportunities for low-income populations. And part of ARA was an additional $5+ billion, and they're debating, you know, additional money for next year potentially, which could be used for one-time non-recurrent benefits, to cover the expenditure of increased caseloads, or for subsidized employment programs within certain you know, mathematical formulas for how you get that money. So state TANF bureaus are another source of money for subsidized employment programs or unsubsidized employment programs for those workers.
Okay, that's great. Does anyone, do any of our speakers have anything else to add? Okay. Before I go on to the next question, I just wanted to let everyone on the webinar know that the PowerPoint for today's webinar will be emailed to all the people who participated today, as well as they're going to be available in about the next week on the Welfare Peer TA website for downloading. So I just wanted to let everyone know that. Operator, do we have any questions via the phone?
We have two questions on the phone lines.
Okay.
And the first question comes from the line of Carlos Serrano Juan. Please proceed.
Sorry, that question was already answered. Thank you.
Question comes from the line. It's a follow-up question from the line of Deborah Pontiso. Please proceed.
Yes. I just have a quick question.
for community-based organizations, or if they have clients in their caseload that they know need jobs, I mean, it seems to me that it's kind of a hodgepodge of different actors that are at play, that are in this play, and in terms of training opportunities, if I was to advise some of our local child support agencies that if you come across non-custodial fathers who are out of work, can't pay their child support, and we wanted to refer them to sort of green jobs training opportunities, what would I tell them? What is one kind of point for sure? Are workforce investment boards the best place? Are they always intersected with this and throughout most of the states, or is it where they have to fend for themselves and find out who to refer their clients to?
Are you talking about where should people go for training, or which jobs should they be training for?
Maybe both. I'm not sure about the jobs as much as well. No, I am. I guess I'm doing both. I mean, what jobs are, you know, opportunities exist, and then if they need training, where would they go? I mean, is there one entity that could kind of, if I have to refer them to one entity, and even though that one entity may have to refer them again, what is the safe bet
This is Jennifer. For finding out about training opportunities, usually it's the state workforce investment board, but also at the local level. If they went to the one stop, all states are required to maintain an eligible training provider list.
Yeah.
Now these are the people who are eligible to. They're the companies, the training providers that are eligible to receive Workforce Investment Act funds.
Right.
So it's not necessarily all training that's out there.
Okay.
But it's the ones where people would be eligible to get a WEA training grant.
Okay.
So it's one of the more comprehensive listings. You know, in terms of the demand, I mean, that's a little bit trickier. Because traditionally the measures of demand are collected by the state labor department, labor market analysis unit. But unfortunately, a lot of their data doesn't apply very well to green jobs. Some of those offices have done employer surveys and have tried to do other statistical modeling to better get a sense of the demand in green jobs.
Okay.
But my sense is that it's a little bit it's kind of all over the map in that sometimes those types of surveys are done by other entities. So you really have to kind of ask around and get familiar with what's going on in your state to track demand for green jobs.
Okay.
Everyone's doing a little differently.
Okay.
This is Elaine.
Go ahead, Elaine.
I just wanted to add one thing. That just like we were mentioning before, that many green jobs are exist within existing jobs or existing occupations, and just like that's true, much green job training can be found within existing training programs. So folks that are interested in training for green jobs should look in the same places that they would look to find training for regular jobs. And what's happening is that many training programs across the board are incorporating green job training elements or incorporating a particular track that's directed towards some energy efficiency retrofits or something else having to do with green jobs. So that's what I would say.
Thank you very much.
The only thing I would add to this is that there's a slide very early in my presentation talking about a DOL slide where you could get information on who's funded. There may be grantees in the Pathways Out of Poverty program in your local areas.
Okay.
It would be a great idea for the local TANF programs to kind of touch base with those grantees.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just getting started. I mean, they are just starting to ramp up activities, so they are. That now is a very good time to be talking with them about how you can refer into their program.
Wonderful.
I just want to mention, this is Jennifer again. That there's so much rapid development of green training out there and so little regulation of it and so little sort of field testing of a lot of it that, I think it's important to arm the people that are asking training providers about their training with, you know, some good questions to ask. You know, making sure that they're an accredited and licensed provider.
Mm-hmm.
You know, making sure that the credential is one that's you know, well known and in demand in the local labor market. Asking about job placement. You know, those types of things.
Well, that's a very good point. It's kind of the Wild West of the green job training.
Yes, it is.
Jennifer, do you have a website or an email address?
Yes, it's going to be at the back of the presentation, but it's jcleary, C-L-E-A-R-Y,
okay,
at rutgers.edu.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I think we have one final question. Well, we actually have a question for Michelle, but I think she's no longer on. So for the person that was asking about Solar Seattle and is it a replication of Solar Richmond, we'll make sure to send her that question and make sure that everyone kind of knows the answer after this. And then we have one more question.
Okay, we have one more, which I think could be for any of the speakers, and it's, could you expand on any unique strategies that have been employed or ideas you have to recruit, engage, and retain TANF participants for welfare?
Or any Elena, I can share one I want to go back to a point that I made in my presentation, which is the importance or the role of partnerships. Where innovative partnerships exist that incorporate the full range, the full spectrum of, you know, training programs and education institutions, as well as community-based agencies and organizations that serve populations that might be seeking training or employment, and then also incorporate employers. Where those exist, there's been success in getting folks who may be TANF recipients or other folks with barriers to employment or low-income populations, getting them into training and then successfully into employment. And one example that exists out here where I am is the Oakland Green Job Corps, which is a partnership between Cypress Mandela, which is a training program that specifically targets low-income populations and those with barriers to employment, partnership between Cypress Mandela and Laney Community College, and then Growth Sector, which is an intermediary that connects with employers. And training program participants, you know, they start with very basic skills training and move up into construction skills training, and then they have a paid internship with an employer. They have classes that get college credit from the community college, and it really brings folks from, you know, being unemployed or having been in prison or having other kinds of barriers that prevented them from being employed in the past, getting them into high quality training and then into jobs with employers, local employers.
Mm-hmm. This is David Sirloff, my assistant. Just again to agree, I couldn't agree more that the importance of partnerships. You know, state and local TANF agencies can fund training, can fund subsidized employment. They have money set aside for child care, which is a huge barrier for many low-income populations. But people on TANF qualify for a lot of child care support as well. Then the workforce investment boards have that great connection directly to the labor market and to green jobs and whatnot. And then the nonprofit agencies, you know, not only are doing great work in green jobs, as our presenters have shown us, but have the direct connection and local roots in the community. And so the most successful programs that I've seen across the country are the ones that make those connections between federal agencies, state agencies, and the local organizations to build that as many different supports beneath their clients as possible to build those partnerships and connections across the way. And if you're a local agency and interested in making those connections, I encourage you to do so. And you can do so through PRTA. And if you're a state or a federal agency and you help making those connections, same deal. It goes in both directions. Are there any other questions, Lisa?
There's one or two, but it's just at 3:30, so to respect everyone's time on the webinar, we were going to go straight to the poll question.
Absolutely. Brent, you want to go through this?
Actually, I'm not sure I know what it is, so...
Ha ha ha!
The first poll question, it should be on your screen. The speakers had valuable information to share. You can just click on the little buttons and to register your response. All right. Okay, we're going to go to the second poll question. The logistics of the webinar ran smoothly. Okay. The third question, I have a better understanding of which jobs are considered green jobs and how to connect and link TANF and low-income populations to these jobs. Okay, poll question number four. I learned about initiatives creating green jobs in manufacturing and energy efficiency and how to address mechanisms to make sure green jobs are good jobs. Okay, question number five. I've learned which components and features are important in creating a good green job training program. And the final question, I learned strategies that I can use for implementing green workforce development programs in my state, tribe, or local agency and or community. And Brent, I'll turn it over to you to close out.
Okay, well, I want to say thanks to to David for helping us put this on. It's always great to work with our partners at OFA. Thanks to Jennifer and Elena and also Michelle for their presentation. It's very informative. This is a huge area of development in public policy, and everybody is kind of feeling their way forward, trying to figure out the things that make sense, the things that will really yield benefits to all Americans, but certainly including low-income Americans. It's been an honor to see how this initiative has been so intentional about addressing both the environmental concerns that underlie the green jobs movement, but also the social justice and social equity issues that underlie green job training as well. And I think that was very well represented here today on the call. So thank you again to our speakers. Thanks to all of you for joining. We had a great turnout, and there's clearly a high level of interest. So we will, at the Welfare Peer TA Network, continue to be monitoring this, providing updates to the field as warranted. Thanks, everybody, again, for coming.
Thank you so much, everyone. That concludes our webinar today. If you have any further questions, please send them to Welfare Peer TA and check out our website. Thank you so much.